The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 1, Continued. You know, Horace Richards says with a smile, later on, when everyone got so excited about the election, the 1948 election for United States Senator from Texas, that Lyndon Johnson stole, I felt that I had been in on the beginning of history, because I was in on the first election that Lyndon Johnson stole. Johnson's joy in victory was not unalloyed, however. Richards, writing up the elections for the Star, wrote that Johnson had won by a neck's lead, a narrow margin. Johnson was furious over what he regarded as a slur on his victory. "Boy, that boy was angry at me," Richards recalls. "We sat in a car and talked for an hour about that. He said, 'Horace, it just looks to me like you try to dig me every time you get a chance.'" Were even such tactics inadequate for Lyndon Johnson's purposes? He used others. The annual voting for the Gaylardians, the college's 7 prettiest, most popular, and most representative co-eds, aroused the greatest interest of any campus election, far more than the class officer elections. The Gaylardia is a hill country flower. And the voting, by secret written ballots deposited in a ballot box in the ground floor hall of Old Main, was conducted under a strict supervision which would prevent repetition of the multiple voting technique. Previously, most of the winners immortalized in full-page sepia pictures in the pedagogue had been members of the literary society Black Star In Crowd. But now Johnson wanted White Star girls to win as many of the 7 places as possible. Standing in his way were 3 nominees too popular or pretty to be beaten. But he was confident that his vigorous campaigning would win 4 places, confident, that is, until Ruth Lewis was nominated. Unlike the other candidates, Ruth Lewis was not a campus beauty. But although in practice the Gaylardian election was mainly a beauty contest, it was not supposed to be. Representative was defined as foremost in college life. Miss Lewis had other qualifications. There was always a twinkle in her eye and in her fingers when she sat down at the old Underwood in the pedagogue office where she was an assistant editor. She was a terrific writer, brilliant, says pedagogue editor Ellis O'Rella. She wrote for the Press Club, the Scribblers Club, and was involved in 6 campus activities. And she had ideas as novel on the San Marcos campus of that era as the hair she wore, short and straight, in the defiant and very un-Texan flapper style. An enthusiastic tennis player herself, she believed that women should have their own athletic teams. She did not want to get married as soon as possible, preferring a career in journalism, where her writing could help people. But she argued for her ideas with a quiet earnestness and self-deprecatory humor that made her so popular that when she was nominated for one of the 7 places, it was generally assumed she would win. But then, as Ellis O'Rella puts it, Lyndon found out this dirty little thing about Ruth. The thing was not really dirty, it was not even significant, except in light of the deep feeling of inferiority at San Marcos about the famous University of Texas, just 30 miles away, where richer, smarter students went to college. To understand what happened, you have to understand how defensive we were about going to San Marcos, Miss Sorella says. Johnson's discovery consisted of nothing more than the fact that when 2 men had stopped to fix a flat tire on a car in which Ruth Lewis and 2 friends had been riding, and had asked the young women where they went to college, Miss Lewis, out of defensiveness or embarrassment, had blurted out that they went to the University of Texas, and only later, with a shamefaced grin, had corrected herself. A more trivial incident can hardly be imagined, except that one of the men was an acquaintance of Lyndon Johnson, and happened to mention it to him. Johnson told Miss Lewis that unless she withdrew from the Gaylardian election, the whole campus would know what she had done. Unless she withdrew, he said, he would write an editorial in the Star revealing the incident and stating that she should not be elected because any woman who was ashamed to say she went to San Marcos was not a representative San Marcos co-ed. When Johnson left Ruth Lewis, he knew he had won. He came back after seeing her and said we could stop worrying, Horace Richards says. He had blackmailed her right out of that election, and he knew it. Johnson's assessment was correct. As soon as he had left Miss Lewis, Ellis O'Rella says, she came to my house in tears, which was very unusual for Ruth. She said, I'm going to withdraw from the election. I was astounded. I wanted her to battle him, but she said he was going to put this in big headlines in the newspaper, and she just could not face that embarrassment. She withdrew. The four co-eds Johnson wanted to be Gaylardians were all elected. His next target was the student council. He himself, as a result of the stolen election, was a member, but more than half of the 12 other members, including almost all the seniors and juniors, were athletes and members of the in crowd. I had to rely on the freshmen and sophomores to get the votes to run the student council, he would recall in 1970. He knew how to get them. Use the brains are just important as brawn issue that had touched in other elections. But he had to know whom to use the issue on. He had to learn the identities of bright underclassmen who would either be his candidates for the council or would vote for those candidates. And the inchoate, constantly shifting nature of the San Marcos student body made identifying such students difficult. But Johnson had figured out a way to identify them. As night watchman in Old Main, White Star Archie Wiles possessed keys to the registrar's office. One midnight, Johnson was to recall in that 1970 conversation, we took the keys and went in there, and I got those little yellow grade cards. I got the names of everyone who had a B average. I took the people with superior intellectual ability. Lining up nominees, nominators, and voters, he saw to it that the freshman and sophomore places on the council were filled with students to whom the brains argument would appeal. In selecting women candidates, he took a further precaution. He instructed White Stars to date the freshman and sophomore co-eds he was considering as nominees. Says Wilton Woods, a senior, who did a lot of such dating because his soft voice and tentative manner were attractive to younger girls, Lyndon's idea was to get a real nice-looking girl and see if you could control her. Date her and see how she comes out. See if she'll go along if she was elected to the student council. If Johnson received a report that a girl would go along, he would instruct the White Star who was dating her to ask her to run for the council. I was dating a little old girl, and my sole purpose in dating her was to get her to run, Woods says. That was Lyndon's idea. He wanted me to tell her how to vote once she was elected. The strategy worked. Women at San Marcos were not modern girls, Richards explains. They were not particularly interested in politics. Although they outnumbered men 3-1, no woman, so far as can be determined, had ever been a class president. Johnson's weeding-out process had ensured, moreover, that the women he selected as candidates were even less interested than most. Women at San Marcos were also not modern because, in Richards' words, girls at that time, they'd do what you told them, in areas such as politics that were considered men's domain. And Johnson's process ensured, of course, that his candidates were not particularly independent. And, Whiteside adds, don't forget, these were girls in a school where there were 6 girls to every 2 boys. A lot of the girls were very lonely. The boy was a prized possession. They didn't want to do anything to get you mad at them. Says Woods, seldom did you have to make an issue of it. You'd say, so-and-so wants to be editor of the Star. He's a good old boy. You'll vote for him, won't you? And almost always they would. Johnson employed a similar strategy with at least one woman who was already on the council, having Woods date her as long as Lyndon needed her vote. In this instance, the strategy worked particularly well, for the woman, a lively, dark-haired young lady with dark, glowing eyes, fell in love with Woods. And then, of course, as soon as Lyndon didn't need her vote anymore, old Wilton drops her, Richards laughs. She really liked Wilton, too. And I bet she really used to wonder what had happened. I bet she could never figure out why old Wilton dropped her. Probably she never could, for, varied as were Lyndon Johnson's political tactics, one aspect was common to them all. This aspect would have been striking no matter who was planning the tactics, but it was all the more striking when the tactician was a young man who had displayed throughout his life, and was, in his other non-political activities, displaying still, so notable a tendency for talking big. Lyndon Johnson was planning many tactics now, a whole political strategy, in fact, and he never talked about it at all. Occasionally, his little brother got a glimpse of it. On some weekends, 15-year-old Sam Houston Johnson visited Lyndon, and he would write, never forget those wonderful conversations, monologues, really, that ran through the long Saturday afternoons and Sunday mornings. I heard several installments of his campaign against the Black Stars during my periodic weekend visits to San Marcos, always listening with wide-eyed admiration as my brother outlined his strategy for the coming week. Even now, I can still visualize him restlessly moving back and forth in his room, sometimes lounging on his bed and then moving onto a rickety wooden chair near the window, his eyes gleaming with anticipation and his deep voice tense with emotion. But even Sam Houston got only a glimpse. At Sunday noon, he had to go home, and when he left, his brother would still be pacing and prowling around his little room, his eyes gleaming, his hands clasping and unclasping, his long fingers, nails bitten down to the quick and into the quick, twisting and twining under the tension of hidden thoughts. The White Stars understood the necessity of keeping their existence secret. Students were especially susceptible to the brains are just as important as brawn argument, because they knew that the brawn, the college athletes, belonged to a secret organization, and along with their girlfriends, to an exclusive clique into which most students were not invited. Johnson was playing on that susceptibility quite deliberately. Most of the non-athletic students secretly resented and probably hated the Saturday heroes, no matter how much they apparently enjoyed the games, his brother explains. Quite obviously, since every practical politician knows that hate and fear offer more forceful tools for organizing than love and respect, Lyndon had a rather fertile field at San Marcos. Lyndon had sized up the situation like an old pro. He had that gut knowledge about the little man's resentment of the big man. The susceptibility of the voters, the little men, to whom Johnson was appealing, would be less easily translatable into support for Johnson's candidates if the voters discovered that in being asked to vote for a Deason or a Hartsky, they were being asked to vote for members of another secret organization, also one into which they were not invited. In forming the White Stars, Richards and Whiteside, not for political reasons but to enhance the feeling of brotherhood, fraternity, that was so important to them, had formulated strict rules for secrecy. Johnson devised others which they embraced. No three White Stars could ever be seen talking together on campus, for example. Should three find themselves together, meaningful glances would indicate which one should leave. White Star meetings, previously held down at the creek or in members' rooms in their boarding houses, were now, at Johnson's suggestion, moved to the two-story Hofheinz Hotel, where, Johnson pointed out, no passerby could peep through the windows. There was even an ingenious device to allow a White Star to deny with a straight face that he was one. Immediately upon being asked if he was a member of the group, a White Star rule read, the member is, upon the very asking of the question, automatically expelled, so that he can answer no. He will be readmitted at the next meeting. These rules and others were incorporated into the White Star bylaws, which new members had to swear to uphold in that impressive ceremony with the candle and the dictionary on the creek bank. And so seriously did these young men take this oath that 40 years later, asked about the White Stars, Deason declined to go into detail, in order not to violate certain oaths that I have taken, and others declined to talk at all. So successful was Johnson in his insistence on secrecy that even after White Stars had won many campus elections, the campus did not know that there were White Stars. The Black Stars didn't know we were organized. Nobody knew, Deason says. They didn't know this was an organization working on them. They knew someone was playing havoc with the school, but they didn't know who. Whiteside recalls with glee, all these unsuspecting people we used. We'd say, you're not going to vote with the Black Stars, are you? You're not going to help the Black Stars. and all the time we had another organization that was so secret they didn't know we had one. Johnson also had reasons for keeping his strategy, and even the fact that he had a strategy, secret from the White Stars themselves. Richards and Whiteside, jealous of their leadership, might well balk at a Johnson plan simply because it wasn't their plan. Or if they agreed to it, they might, loudmouths that they were, talk about it, revealing it to the campus at large. Other White Stars might balk at a Johnson plan because of their dislike of him. He couldn't let even his allies know what he was planning. Occasionally, very occasionally, only when it was unavoidable because Johnson needed his help, Bill Deason got a glimpse of the planning. Al Hartsky recalls returning to the little room he shared with Deason and finding his roommate and Johnson sprawled across the bed, calling politics, talking as if there wasn't nothing but politics. I used to call Bill senator and Lyndon governor. But Johnson never gave even Deason, his first candidate and closest ally, more than a glimpse. It took Deason quite some time, in fact, to realize something about the White Star's meetings. They were still informal affairs, loud talk and laughter, and they were still chaired by the group's founders, Richards and Whiteside, who did most of the talking. Lyndon Johnson, in fact, did very little talking at these meetings. But Deason began to notice by a meeting's end the decisions they arrived at, Richards, Whiteside, and the rest, would invariably be the decisions Johnson had told him the night before that he wanted them to arrive at. In discussions that five or six of us would have in a room, he would not be the dominant one, Deason says, but I remember I began to think that he may have controlled the meeting more than we realized, that maybe he was swaying the group. Gradually we came to realize that, at least I did, I came to realize that he had a very clever mind. Gradually, in fact, Deason came to understand something understood by no one else. Richards and Whiteside, the founders of the White Stars, thought they were still running the White Stars, but they weren't. The most striking aspect of Lyndon Johnson's secrecy, however, was not the success with which he imposed it on others, but the success with which he imposed it on himself. All his life he had talked big, had boasted, bragged, swaggered, strutted, tried to stand out, shoved himself into the forefront, so incessantly that he had revealed a need to talk big, a desperate thirst for attention and admiration. This thirst had not been quenched. His boasting and bragging on other subjects, any subject but campus politics, was as errant as ever. It is difficult to escape the conclusion that he talked at length about campus politics to Sam Houston Johnson because he had to talk to someone, had to let someone know how smart he was. And his hero-worshipping little brother was the only listener who, because he was not part of the college and would go back to Johnson City on Sunday, could be trusted not to reveal his secrets on campus. But much as Lyndon Johnson may have wanted to talk on this subject, he said not a word to anyone but his little brother, and in his silence revealed that beneath the skinny, gangling, awkward, big-eared exterior, beneath the rambling monologues and the wild boasting, beneath the fawning and the smiling and the face turned so worshipfully up to the professor's, lay a will of steel. Lyndon Johnson was planning to take a tiny group of outsiders and with them snatch student power. Not only snatch existing power, but create for them and him new power of dimensions no students had ever had on campus before. If anyone on campus, even his allies, realized his purposes, he would not be able to accomplish them. If anyone saw what he was doing, he would not be able to do it. And no one saw. The success with which he cloaked his maneuvers in secrecy was demonstrated most dramatically during the selection, in May 1930, of the following year's Star and Pedagogue editors. Merit, not politics, had traditionally been the criterion for filling these posts, not only the highest paying, but the most influential available to undergraduates. In filling them, the student council had always accepted the recommendations of the incumbent editors, who nominated their most qualified assistants from the junior class. In May 1930, the nominees for the Star and Pedagogue editorships, respectively, were a brother and sister who lived in San Marcos, Henry and Meadie Kyle. They were so clearly the best qualified students, as was another townie, Edward Pules, for pedagogue business manager, that there would appear to be no question that they would be selected. "We just assumed they would," says pedagogue editor Ellis O'Rella. "They, the council, had never failed to do this before." Kyle's reforming zeal, he advocated not only less emphasis on athletics and a more equitable distribution of the blanket tax, but more independent reading to supplement the almost total reliance on textbook work, and adoption in honors courses of the Oxford method of fewer examinations so that students could pursue lines of study without being tied to rigid curricula, had been thwarted during the elections a month before, but he was already planning to resurrect the campaign in the Star. While the council was meeting in Old Main, the three friends, who had grown up together in San Marcos, sat together on a bench outside, awaiting notification of their election. But it was Horace Richards and Wilton Woods who emerged from the building, and as they saw the waiting trio, they started giggling. Pules and the Kyles soon found out what they were giggling about. When a member of the council, a friend, appeared, he told them that there had been surprising developments at the meeting. A new rule had been suggested. He had objected to it, and so had others, but a vote had been quickly called for, and, with the council's freshman and sophomore members voting for it, along with a single senior, Lyndon Johnson, the rule had been quickly passed by the margin of a single vote. This rule, the friend said, made residents of San Marcos ineligible for Star and pedagogue jobs, because, since they lived at home, they didn't need the salaries as much as other students. And with the depression at hand, jobs should go to students in need. The new rule had made Pules and the Kyles ineligible, the friend said. The jobs they had expected had gone instead to students who had not previously been considered in the running. The Star editorship to Osler Dunn, a junior whose previous role on the paper had been so minor that his picture had not even been included among those in the pedagogue section devoted to the newspaper. The post of Star business manager to Harvey Yeo, a freshman, the first freshman in anyone's memory to have received such an honor. Mortified though they were at the injustice of the new rule, far from not needing money, Pules needed it badly. He had been counting on the pedagogue salary to pay his tuition. Without it, he would have to drop out of college. They had no inkling at first that it had been devised solely to make them ineligible. And they had no inkling that Lyndon Johnson had done the devising. Kyle was especially shocked to learn the truth. He and Johnson were very different young men. The slender, bespectacled, studious Kyle was a voracious reader, a brilliant student who received in reality the A's that Johnson only said he received, a brilliant debater who, undefeated during his junior year, won in reality the debating victories that Johnson only said he won. But they shared an interest in politics, although Kyle was more interested in the science than the practice. They argued constantly in history and social science courses. Kyle, a professor says, could argue Johnson to a standstill. He had read the books that Johnson only said he had read. But Kyle had enjoyed those arguments, had thought the give and take of ideas was what college was all about, and he had believed that Johnson enjoyed them too. During Johnson's pre-Catula days at college, Kyle says, I befriended him when no one else would have anything to do with him. And Johnson had apparently reciprocated, inviting him to his home to meet his parents. During Johnson's post-Catula days, he had needed the support of townies for Deason's election, and as Kyle was their leader, had cultivated him. I thought we were friends, Kyle says. Enraged, though he had been, by Richards's railroading of the junior class vote, he had thought that Johnson was only one of the group following Richards around that day. He had not the slightest suspicion that Johnson was its leader. Now he had not the slightest suspicion of Johnson's role in conceiving the depression argument that had deprived him of the editorship. And he was as unaware of the existence of a secret organization called the White Stars as he was of how Lyndon Johnson really felt about being argued to a standstill. The previous year, Kyle recalls now, two of his henchmen, Richards and Woods, asked me would I be willing to be a member of a group that would try to get more money for these literary activities, forensic activities, because the football team was getting too much money. I never got the idea that it was a secret group. I never knew that Lyndon was even a member of it. after he declined the invitation. "I said all these people you are fighting are my friends." He never again, although he previously had been class president, won another student office. Without understanding how, he felt that Richards and Woods were somehow behind those defeats. Now he felt that, in some way he didn't understand, they were also behind his defeat for the editorship. And as soon as he learned about it, he recalls, "I sought them out and stopped them on the side of Old Main and cursed them with every name in the book. They just stood and looked at me and grinned." But he never guessed, never had even a suspicion, who was behind Richards and Woods. Not until the very last part of school, some weeks after the decisive council meeting, was Kyle told that Johnson had been the moving force at the meeting, and that, moreover, Lyndon had been working for years to keep me from getting any honors at all. Pules also suspected nothing. "All the time this was going on," he says, "whenever he saw Lyndon Johnson on the campus, Johnson would smile in a friendly way and stop and talk just like nothing was happening." Pules, ironically, in light of the argument Johnson had used to sway the council, had to spend a horrible year in Bishop, Texas, to earn enough money to return to college. He left for Bishop, he says, with a bad taste in his mouth. He, Johnson, started the politicking at San Marcos, Pules says. He had to start it. If he hadn't done the politicking and maneuvering, he couldn't have been outstanding. He wasn't an outstanding student, and he wasn't outstanding in anything else. He was just the type of character who was snaky all the time. He got power by things you or I wouldn't stoop to. But he got the power, and he cheated us out of jobs we'd worked very hard for and had earned. Kyle and his sister had enough money to continue at San Marcos, but they dropped out too, and would not return until Johnson had graduated and left. "We left college because of him," Kyle says, "because of disgust at what he did." The disgust would not fade for years, Kyle's friends say. Says Ellis O'Rella, who did not herself learn until years later the real reason the council rejected her recommendation for her successor, "Henry was very smart, and he was very idealistic, and he just could not tolerate what he saw as political purposes." Says another student, who was asked not to be identified, "It was as if Henry, who had lived a very sheltered life, found out all at once just how dirty life could really be." Class presidents, student council members, Galeardians, Star and Pedagogue editors. When Lyndon Johnson had returned from Cotulla in June 1929, all had been members of a clique that had scorned Lyndon Johnson. By the time he graduated in August 1930, all had been replaced by members of a clique led, in fact, if not in name, by Lyndon Johnson. His enemies had been supplanted by his allies, and with remarkable speed. In little more than a year, he, a young man with a long-standing interest in politics but absolutely no political experience, had manipulated a campus political structure, created a campus political structure, so that he, still one of the most disliked students on campus, exerted over it more influence than any other student. Thinking back on those wonderful monologues, I can clearly see that political stratagems have always been my brother's natural vocation and favorite pastime, Sam Houston Johnson writes. Natural vocation, the insight of a brother who, throughout his life, would display considerable brotherly insight. Lyndon Johnson had come to his new field already an expert in it. His brother understood part of the reason for this aptitude. "His penchant for nose counting comes from Daddy," he wrote. For nose counting, and for much else. The tall, gangling, big-eared young man with the lapel-holding mannerism and the powerful talent for persuasion was, after all, the son of a man with the same mannerism and the same talent. The young man possessed of an instinctive gift for a campus version of backroom maneuvering was the son of a man who, coming to the state capitol without experience, had displayed immediately a similar gift. But there was a crucial difference between father and son, as a single contrast demonstrates. His father's most gallant fight was the one he waged, alone in the Texas House of Representatives, except for six forlorn allies, against Joseph Weldon Bailey, the populist who had betrayed the populists. Once in a history class, Lyndon Johnson was asked if he had a particular hero. "Joe Bailey," he replied. Sam Ely Johnson, an idealist straight as a shingle, whose uncompromising adherence to the beliefs and principles with which he had entered politics made him a hero to some, was nonetheless a political failure who didn't accomplish any of his most cherished aims. His son had, in the campus arena, which was the only arena in which he had yet fought, accomplished his aims, because the impedimenta which hampered his father did not hamper him. He had believed in nothing. Without a reform he wanted to make, without a principle or issue about which he truly cared. We didn't care if the argument was true or not. He had demonstrated, moreover, not only a pragmatism foreign to his father, but a cynicism foreign as well. He had persuaded students, had persuaded them earnestly, his arm around their shoulders, looking intently into their eyes, that they should not cast votes that would help a secret organization, without letting them know that he was a member of a secret organization. A cynicism and a ruthlessness. He didn't merely count votes, he stole them. In what a lieutenant termed blackmail, he had threatened a frightened girl with the exposure and exaggeration in big headlines of a meaningless momentary indiscretion. He had exploited the loneliness of women. The son of the man of whom you always knew where he stood, let no one know where he stood. Men like Kyle and Pules, into whose ambitions he was scheming to plunge a knife, thought he was their friend until the knife was in up to the hilt. These tactics had, of course, been employed within the confines of campus politics, so small-scale and insignificant compared to the politics of the outside world. Within these confines, nonetheless, had emerged a certain pattern to the tactics, the politicking of Lyndon Johnson. Perhaps the most significant aspect of the pattern was its lack of any discernible limits. Pragmatism had shaded into the morality of the ballot box, a morality in which nothing matters but victory, and any maneuver that leads to victory is justified, into a morality that is amorality. And how did Lyndon Johnson himself feel about the ruthless methods he had employed? Many years later, 40 years later, in 1970, after he had left the presidency, Lyndon Johnson returned to San Marcos and spent an entire day touring the campus and reminiscing. Late in the afternoon, he sat chatting with four of his former professors, five old men in the shade, and the talk turned to his White Star activities, and to the student council, and he made the following statement. "The freshmen, the sophomores, and me, we had a majority. We gave to the band, the dramatic club, the debaters, and we started electing the Gaylardians. We were still doing it when I left. I don't know what happened after I left, but we were still doing it when I left. It was a pretty vicious operation for a while. They lost everything I could have them lose. It was my first real big Hitlerized operation, and I broke their back good. And it stayed broke for a good long time." The day had been long, particularly for a man with a serious heart condition, and Lyndon Johnson was tired when he made that statement. Perhaps it was the tiredness that let those words, particularly those two words, dictator and Hitlerized, slip out. But he was not so tired that he didn't realize what he had said as soon as he had said it. Abruptly cutting off the conversation, he rose from his seat, gathered his aides, and strode away. Had not a young man been present with a tape recorder, posterity would not possess Lyndon Johnson's own assessment of his first political activity. But it was a revealing assessment, not merely because he had seen himself as a dictator, a Hitler, and had not recoiled from the sight. The overall tone of the assessment is more revealing than those two words. "It was a pretty vicious operation for a while. They lost everything I could have them lose. I broke their back good, and it stayed broke for a good long time." Did he not see the ruthlessness? He saw it. Was he ashamed of it? He was proud of it. A pretty vicious operation. And sometimes Lyndon Johnson displayed a viciousness that had little to do with the operation. Black Star Frank Arnold was slow academically, but an immensely strong, quiet, and gentle boy, he had other qualities. His courage playing football, despite a series of painful injuries, had led his teammates to elect him captain and call him Old Reliable. Off the field, a friend says, he was the kind of boy who always had something nice to say to everyone. And sometimes he had a knack, despite his slowness, of seeing to the heart of a situation. During that student council vote on the Star and Pedagogue editorships, for example, he had turned on Johnson and said that he didn't believe in giving something to someone who hadn't earned it. He was the kind of boy that everyone liked, except Lyndon, the friend says. Lyndon didn't like him at all. Arnold, slow though he was dearly loved by one of the brightest girls on campus, pert, pretty Helen Hoppines. Johnson devised a scheme to break them up. His instrument was Whiteside, the fast-talking, handsome ladies' man. Lyndon had a Model A, Whiteside recalls. He'd say, call her up and take her out. Take my car, just to aggravate him. He got a real kick out of that, because he didn't like Frank Arnold. Says Helen, I'd been going with Frank Arnold for years. I was in love with him. And then all of a sudden, Vernon Whiteside, he just gave me a frantic rush for 2 weeks, meeting me after class and sitting under the trees. I was so naive I never thought Lyndon was back of it. I just thought I had blossomed out. I never took it serious. I was too in love with Frank Arnold. But it was exciting. Even when she accepted Arnold's ring, Whiteside persisted. Lyndon would say, why don't you call her? Get a date tonight and make her take old Frank's ring off. I'd go up there, and Helen was wearing his engagement ring, and I'd go up there and talk her into taking it off. The next day it would be back on, but you could see Frank walking around with that worried look on his face. He was so wrapped up in her. Whiteside's courtship ended, he says, when I finally got ashamed of myself. Had it been up to Johnson, the false courtship would have continued until the true one had been shattered beyond repair. That wasn't politics, Whiteside says. That was just Lyndon. Arnold and Helen Hoppines were married. He died in 1955. Sometimes the viciousness had nothing at all to do with the operation. One student, a Bohemian farm boy, was generally immune from practical jokes because he was so slow and gullible. Some students believed he might be slightly retarded, as to be too defenseless a target. This student had a severe case of acne, and one evening, talking with Johnson, Whiteside, and another student, he said girls wouldn't go out with him because of it. Recalls Whiteside. Lyndon said to him that the cure was to get fresh cow manure and put it on your face. He said, oh, go on. Lyndon said, didn't you ever turn over a cow pile and see how white the grass was underneath, how the manure bleached the grass? So Lyndon said, let's drive the boy out to get some. We all four of us drove out to some pasture, and he gets out and walks a long ways, and we can't believe he's this gullible, and he comes back with some which he had put in a shoebox. When they return to San Marcos, Lyndon tells him to take a towel and cut eye holes in it and wrap it around his face. He came into our room and asked how it was, and Lyndon said, you don't have enough on to do any good. He made him put more on. In the morning, he smelled so bad you couldn't go near him. Then Lyndon tells everyone the story, and the next day, when the boy walks in, everyone goes, moo! I tell you, that was the worst thing I ever took part in. Johnson's flattery of President Evans had continued, and so had its results. Prexy now displayed toward Lyndon a friendliness he had never displayed to any other student, or for that matter to any faculty member. Friendliness that was almost paternal. So at home was Johnson in Evans's office now that the impression Tom Nichols had noted before Johnson left for Cotulla, some of them probably thought he was running the place, was strengthened. Professors, noting that he had Prexy's ear, tried to get his. As he was secretary of Dr. Evans, I always stopped and had a little chat with him, one says. Even Deans Noly and Speck were wary of him, leery of crossing him. The strict Noly, for example, had never relaxed the rule requiring a student to take 6 physical education courses. When, before he left for Cotulla, Johnson, embarrassed by his awkwardness and lack of physical coordination, asked Noly for permission to write a paper on athletics instead of attending physical education class, Noly had refused, and Johnson had received an F in the course. Now, when Johnson repeated the request, Nolley granted it. The meek Speck, as an ex officio member of both the Student Council and the Publications Council, was frequently in Johnson's company, and since one student, it was hard to tell who was the student and who was the dean. Then Evans, in an informal way, let his deans know that he wanted Johnson to have a say in assigning students to campus jobs. The grip of the Depression, which had started early in the Hill Country, had tightened. A few years before, 3 bales of cotton would have brought enough money at the gin to send a child to college for a year. Now prices had fallen so low that 6 to 8 bales were needed. 6 to 8 bales of that man-killing labor in the fields, so that a man's son wouldn't have to labor in the fields. Talk to a score of Hill Country men, and a score remember their mothers taking the cotton money and adding it to the pennies they had saved out of the egg money and hiding it away, and trying desperately not to take it out until tuition time came. Professors tried to help. Some loaned students money. Others, with no money to loan, borrowed money from the bank against their next paycheck to give a young man or woman another term at school. Nonetheless, many students had to pack their cardboard suitcases and turn away from Old Main's spires. Of 1,187 students enrolled at San Marcos during the spring term of 1929, only 906 came back in the fall. A good figure, the Star said, because times in this district are hard. It is known that many sacrifices were made. Jobs, those 20-cent-an-hour jobs on the rock squad, those set-the-alarm-for-3 a.m. boiler room jobs, were precious now. 20 cents an hour, and you either went to school or you didn't, Horace Richards says. And Richards says, if Lyndon would say to the deans, this boy's a good boy, give him a job, he'd get that job. Evans had handed Johnson what was, at a poor boy's school, real power. And what Johnson did with that power was revealing. He gave his friends jobs, the best jobs. Within a few months after his return from Cotulla, the $25-a-month part-time inside jobs, which formerly had been held almost entirely by black stars, were held almost entirely by white stars. But he didn't give himself a job to supplement his salary as Evans's assistant. The regular paycheck he had received at Cotulla had enabled him to pay his debts, but not to save any money for the year ahead, and with his spending as free as ever, he still needed money badly. But there were only a few $25 jobs, and he didn't take one. Every job he controlled, he gave away. Money had always been important to him, but there was something more important. In the opinion of some of his allies, the manner with which he gave showed what was important. He was always willing and ready to do whatever he could. In fact, it seemed to please him for you to ask him to do something for you, one says. But you had to ask. He insisted on it. One white star was too proud to do so. No job was given to him. When this student told Richards that he was going to drop out of school, Richards, thinking that Johnson must be unaware of the situation, told him about it. Johnson, he found, was fully aware, but adamant. He told Richards, if he's got too much pride to ask me for a job, I ain't going to give him one. Let him ask me. If he asks me, I'll give him anything I've got, but he's got to ask me. The White Star asked, and was given. Lyndon wanted to show off his power, see, Richards says. The opinion is echoed by other White Stars. What was important to Johnson, they feel, was the acknowledgement, the deferential, face-to-face acknowledgement that he had power. This book is continued on cassette number 8, side 1.